The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Dear Media IRL is back, and we're showing up bigger, better, and louder than ever. Join us on May 4th in Austin, Texas for the ultimate live podcasting experience. Watch and learn from your favorite Dear Media hosts as they bring their insightful discussions from your headphones to the stage. Get ready to be inspired, entertained, and watch audio get a makeover. Tickets are on sale now at dearmedia.com/IRL. See you on May 4th in Austin, Texas.
Hi, it's Dr. Will Cole. This podcast is the manifesto for a new breed of health seekers. This is the art of being well. What's up and welcome to The Art of Being Well. I am a leading functional medicine doctor. I get to consult people around the world via telehealth, and I'm a New York Times bestselling author. If you want to learn more about our clinical work, the telehealth center, we have brand new telehealth patient options now open and lots of free resources for you to reclaim your health for free, all at drwillcole.com. That's drwillcole.com. And listeners, we're giving away free healthy stuff every episode, almost every episode, and every single month, certainly. We're giving away free signed books. We're giving away free supplement protocol stacks that we have at drwillcole.com. We're giving away free functional medicine telehealth consults. So you get to pick one if you win. All you have to do for a chance to win is head on over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review The Art of Being Well there. Tell us what you love about the show. You can leave your Instagram handle in the Apple Podcast review itself, or you could take a screenshot of your review and message me on Instagram at Dr. Will Cole. And every single month, my team and I will be going through the messages on Instagram as well as the Apple Podcast reviews themselves and randomly picking winners every month. I'll reach out to you and you can let me know what you want. You can either get one of the supplement stacks, free signed book, or we can get you scheduled for your telehealth consult. Good luck. All right, let's get to today's guest. She is a wealth of information. I know you're going to love this conversation. Her name is Shrungla Holacek. Shrungla has been immersed in the knowledge and cultural traditions of Ayurveda and holistic medicine since birth. Her ancestors were the Ayurvedic doctors for the Indian royal family, and for centuries, they have organically farmed and crafted the world's finest botanical oils on their farm in central India. Shrungla strives to give people access to powerful, organic, artisanal products that deliver dramatic results and wisdom to empower and embolden our choices in our self-care. Let's get right to it. This is Shrungla Holacek's Art of Being Well. Shrungla, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Really excited to be here.
Yeah. So first of all, you have a beautiful name. And I've never heard it before. I mean, what's it mean? I love the meaning behind names. So can we start there? Random question.
It's a great one, especially because I still am trying to find the meaning behind it. Because in Hindi / Sanskrit, it means series. And I'm one of two. So there isn't really so much of a series as opposed to competing theories about how my parents wanted to make my life difficult by making it full of consonants, as well as it was completely a whim and fancy as my father was watching a cricket series on television at the time he thought about naming me. So yes, but I do have my first name on many email providers, which is helpful. So
it's beautiful. Your parents did right by you, but the meaning, I guess you're still trying to figure out what they're, did your parents ever give you a straight answer? Or are you getting different answers from them?
It has evolved just like life has.
The truth is coming out as you get older, right? That's funny. All right, let's jump into it. Just with a basic question, I'm assuming most of the listeners know this already, but just for the people that are maybe still learning about it, just briefly, Ayurvedic medicine, Ayurveda, can you just define that for the people that are not aware of it? And let's get it deep and teach people all about it.
Let's do it, or at least I will try. But at the top, Ayurveda is an ancient, about 5,000 to 7,000 year old system of medicine that originated in India. And I use my words carefully because first, it is a system of medicine, but it's also as much a system of life, lifestyle. The word stands for science of life. Ayurveda, Veda being science, Ayur being life. And it's as much a protocol on how you should live, sleep, eat, as it is on curing disease and being vital. It was also traditionally an oral system of medicine for the first thousands of years. So it was relied upon rather heavily via practitioners who needed to know what they are doing. Unlike today when someone can, you know, sort of read a little bit about Ayurveda on the internet and become an expert. But I underscore that point in that initial Ayurveda was really a well-studied, well-imbibed, and very deeply practiced system of medicine, which allowed the ancient practitioners to get such a deep understanding of the human body, the human mind, diseases, longevity, and the environment that the body operates in, which is why sometimes we go back to relying on those ancient principles as we do even in the modern day practice of Ayurveda.
Thank you for that. And obviously there's so many unique aspects of Ayurveda that's only in Ayurveda, and we're going to get into that today. But then I think of some of the similarities, and I'd love to get your thought on this, but how I see at least some parallel similarities between Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine. I think in like the non-Western idea of diagnosis and how things, understanding how the body's interconnected. What are your thoughts there? And if you had to say, if there are similarities, what are some of the similarities between Ayurveda and TCM?
I agree wholeheartedly. And I think some of it goes back to what we can see today with modern science, you know, x-rays and blood tests was not available then to practitioners. So the study of the human body had to take diagnostic approaches like seeing someone's tongue, seeing someone's pulse, seeing the color of their skin, how their eyes looked in terms of presenting symptoms of possible disease down the line and finding curative approaches. Then you compound that with the fact that a lot of synthesized medicine was not available at the time. So just like Ayurvedic medicine, TCM relies on a lot of natural herbs to have curative properties. And unlike Western medicine, in some senses, certainly not unlike your style of medicine, but I would say the mass pharma approach, Ayurveda and Chinese medicine tend to be preventative before disease manifests itself rather than attacking a symptom only after the disease has manifested. So that's another similarity. And then there is that body of work where you manipulate marma points in Ayurveda to relieve the body of ailments. And similarly, you find Chinese medicine has stimulation in the foot. And there, I find a lot of similarities between marma points as well as TCM when it comes to manipulating the body and certain energy centers that I have not seen done in Western medicine.
Yeah, agreed. And I think that's the beautiful synergy between Ayurveda, TCM, functional medicine. It's like really, there's so much synergy between our fields for sure. You mentioned marma points. I think many people haven't heard of that term. It sounds like maybe like meridians, right? Energy centers within the body. Is that the same or different? Can you define that?
There are 108 marma points, 106 to 108, depending. Like I mentioned, it was an oral science. So sometimes we find some differences. But the belief is that stimulation of those points can lead to release of energy, detoxification in the body, improved circulation. And in the range of easy to manipulate to hard, that's when practitioner knowledge comes in a big way, because Ayurveda also believes almost in that Achilles heel phenomenon that certain marma points should not be handled or manipulated by the untrained practitioner because it can cause something as death. sort of like, you know, Achilles when hurt on his heel. In fact, our navel is one of those more sensitive areas within the Marma points. But moving on to some of the lighter areas, there are Marma points in our face, which get up an advanced practitioner, or not even that advanced, a practitioner facialist trained in Ayurvedic facials can help stimulate, and that will lead to anything such as better detoxification, better lymphatic detoxification, immediately feeling rejuvenated after a facial. So those are the 108 energy points that lead to, you know, better circulation, as well as a trained practitioner can manipulate them to detoxify the bodies. I have talked to many practitioners who have experienced strong, bad odors emanating from someone when they manipulate their bodies, like rotten meat and things like that. And an unpleasant experience, it's the body getting rid of some of the toxins. So that's Marma Point therapy in Ayurveda.
Wow, amazing. Most of you know I've been drinking AG1 for a long time now. And today I've got an extra special offer for you all so that you can start optimizing your health today. For years, I've been drinking AG1 every day when I get to the telehealth center, no exceptions. Taking care of your health isn't always easy, but it should at least be simple. It's just one scoop. I mix it in water once a day, every day. It is a sustainable, practical micro habit that has maximum benefits for how you feel and supporting maximum health. Think of AG1 like a green superfood, a multivitamin, multimineral, an adaptogen blend, a functional mushroom blend, a gut support blend, all in one scoop. It's your daily dose of vitamins, minerals, prebiotics, probiotics, and so much more. It's a powerful, healthy habit that supports foundational nutrition. My job, my day job beyond the podcast, is looking at labs and getting people healthy. Well, for new telehealth patients, we see nutrient deficiencies ubiquitously. And AG1 fills in the gaps of the most common, the most important nutrient deficiencies, which impact so many different systems in your body. I know with AG1 that I'm giving my body high quality nutrition. Every batch of AG1 goes through a rigorous testing process. You know it's safe. And their ingredients are sourced for absorption, potency, and nutrient density. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of immune supporting, body supporting vitamin D3, K2. And for a limited time, you'll get 10 free AG1 travel packs. Yes, that's 10 travel packs with your first purchase at drinkag1.com/willcole. That's drinkag1.com/willcole. Check it out while this offer lasts. The CDC estimates that there are approximately 96 million American adults. More than one in three people have prediabetes. That's shocking. Of those with prediabetes, more than 80% of people don't even know they have it. Why does this matter? Foods high in carbohydrates raise our blood sugar more than other foods. During digestion, the pancreas produces insulin, which then binds the sugar in the blood and takes it into cells as a source of energy. If you have prediabetes, sugar begins to build up in the bloodstream rather than fuel the cells. This is toxic, and this is when insulin resistance occurs, which is the number one cause of prediabetes. A healthy weight allows insulin to work more efficiently and can help to keep blood sugars within normal range. A healthy diet and sleep are some of the best ways to help bring your blood sugar levels back to a healthy range. What I love to look at data in this area for telehealth patients is a continuous glucose monitor. I love the one from Cygnos. You can literally see which foods can cause your blood sugar to fluctuate throughout the day, and you can learn about your own bioindividuality. We're all different. On average, people make about 227 food choices a day. You can learn the difference between stress eating and physical hunger, better manage your energy throughout the day, and optimize your sleep better at night with unique to you data. Cygnos is going to remove the guesswork of your weight loss and wellness goals and provide you with the tools and knowledge that you need to develop healthier habits. It combines your glucose data from the CGM, or the continuous glucose monitor, with an AI-driven app to deliver you real-time glucose insights for optimal health and weight management. Right now, Signos has an exclusive offer for our listeners. Go to signos.com, that's SIGNOS.com, and get up to 20% off select plans by using code WILLCOLE today. That's signos.com. Use code WILLCOLE to get up to 20% off select plans for you today. So I know people have heard are aware of Ayurvedic medicine to a certain degree, have heard of doshas. Let's start with the next question. Doshas, can we define that? And then I'll get into the different kinds of doshas.
Yes. And I will attempt to do it justice, like I tried to do justice to the dense topic of Ayurveda. But doshas, of which we believe to be three, Vata, Pitta, Kapha, are, you can call it an energy, you can call it a constitution, but essentially it is natural elements combining to express themselves in your body. So Vata is air and ether, Pitta is fire and water, and Kapha is water and earth. And that will start to give you a little bit of a cue into those energy types. But basically, Ayurveda believes that all of the universe and everything in it is made up of these five elements. And then they combine in the human body as in pairs of two and present themselves thus. Now, an important thing to call out is all of us have all the three doshas in our body, but the times that we talk about the doshas, typically the predominant dosha, which is the person's prakriti. So many people end up thinking that I am one dosha, but you're actually a combination of many doshas with one predominant one. And sometimes that might change based on your lifestyle, diet, habits, and more. That's when your prakriti goes into something called your vikriti, which is what Ayurvedic doctors try to bring back through food, herbs, things like panchakarma.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to ask you about panchakarma. So we'll get into that. You read my mind. Okay. So before we, I have a sidebar question, sidebar right now. Qi in TCM, is there a similar parallel to the concept of qi in Ayurveda, or is it the doshas?
I would say it's a good question. I would equate qi almost to the universal energy in terms, in the way I understand it, because there's just qi as opposed to anything subcategories. And I would say, I would think of the doshas as one step below that vital energy, if you will.
I've heard of the, I mean, forgive my ignorance, but I've heard of the reference of prana. Is prana as
you are exactly right. Okay. Prana is the life, and qi would equate to that worldwide dominant energy that lives and breathes through us.
Got it. So understanding the doshas would then, and this is all theoretical, I get this. On the practical level, people don't need to care this, but I'm a nerd. So improving the prana or the life force of our body or the qi in TCM, is that then the balancing of the doshas is how you would do that?
That would be one critical component of it. Absolutely. Because prana gets hampered by a doshic imbalance. And then we'll also start to go into the Agni of the body, which while it relates to the doshas, but is also a force. I mean, in layman's terms, I would call it almost a metabolic fire, but it's more profound than that and sort of, you know, starts to be a little bit on some of the spiritual sides of healing the body. But yes, prana gets impacted through the doshas, but there are ways of thinking about it also gets impacted by negative thoughts or things that might be impacting you psychologically and that will manifest in changes in prana. So it is all interconnected, of which, you know, balancing your doshas would be a very important part of helping you thrive.
Yeah. And that's what we see too clinically with and through the lens of functional medicine is physiological stressors, but also psychological stressors. That's why I called my book, the latest book, Gut Feelings, looking at the gut and the feelings. And that's kind of what you're saying here. These things seen through the Ayurvedic lens that could imbalance the doshas. And I find it beautiful in a way, and I haven't looked at, you know, the correlation of this between the three different doshas. And even there's so much symbolism within nature of the three column system, the positive, negative, neutral, like electron, proton, neutron. I mean, so many things, right? Between nature. Is there that same symbolism seen within Ayurvedic medicine as well?
Say more about that a little bit, because there are two or three things that come to mind, and I'm just trying to understand the way you're going into it a little bit further so I can try to see if there's a precise analogy.
Well, it seems like, to answer the question, I guess, would be even understanding the differences, the characteristic differences between Vata, Pitta, and Kapha. So is one more, you mentioned the elements.
Yes.
Is one more on the left side or like fiery? Is one more on the water side? So I think you touched on that, but I want to understand maybe if you could go through each one and talk about some of the characteristic differences. And maybe you mentioned we have all of these in our body, but maybe how does one find out their dominant dosha?
All great questions. So starting with Vata, it's air and ether. And this one's easy to translate to a person because you start to see some of those creative qualities in that person. They're typically high energy. They're typically very flighty. These are also people who are very anxious. They're friends that can't stay on one topic, but that also makes them great creatives. They're also people who generally have trouble putting on weight. Their skin is typically drier. Their hair is typically thinner and more frazzled. And you asked this great question about how do you know? It's a complicated question to answer because what I touched on pretty much are someone's external qualities that you might choose to judge someone's prakriti on. However, the zinger is you can start acting like that prakriti or that dosha when something has imbalanced your natural dosha. So if you've been doing things that exacerbate Vata in the body, and even though you were born Pitta, and you're born literally at the time of conception, so the time the zygote forms. So you, let's say, were established a Pitta, but start doing things that are extremely Vata provoking, you can start presenting like a Vata person. So while you can try to judge someone by their external presentation, assuming they're in balance, the only telltale way realistically is to do two things. One, see a practitioner, very practiced diagnostician, will be able to read your pulse and tell you in a matter of minutes what your dominant prakriti / dosha is. And the second thing is revisit a dosha quiz or anything you might take in 2 or 3 months' time to see where you might be landing and that you're not just out of balance because of seasonal or lifestyle changes. But coming back to the question of Vata Pitta characteristics, fire and water. So there is a duality. Fire presents itself in a big way in Pittas. They have sensitive skin, very prone to redness and very prone to sunburn, but also they have fiery personalities. They're great orators, they're great politicians, and they also have metabolic issues that are fiery. So these are the ones that will have a lot of digestive issues and indigestion of the acidic kind. And finally, going to the kaphas, which are water and earth, this tends to be the slow, steady, slow-moving dosha. So they're constitutionally typically taller, well-built, and also very stable people. We find a lot of CEOs have kapha personalities because decision-making, they are people who've thought through stuff. They are also people who can be relied on. The flip side is when in imbalance, this dosha gets very sluggish. When you are imbalanced, especially let's say in times of winter, this is the dosha with a tendency to become very oily and gain weight or break out. So these are some of the external physical signs of the dosha manifesting itself. But a proper diagnosis would involve your pulse, your dreams, your childhood, how you behaved when you were a child. And, you know, just like I think of your work as profound, because when you need to see a practitioner, you need to see a practitioner, and no amount of, you know, self-prescribing supplements will help you. That's sort of the good Ayurvedic practitioner's value in life. You see this person, they put you, they help you understand your dosha, they put you in a on a panchakarma protocol if needed, which is on the extreme side, but sometimes it's needed. And the determinate answer only comes from a practitioner.
I love it. And you know what? Just what you're telling me is exactly the ethos of this podcast. There's a science and an art to wellness. And there's this obviously a science and art to understanding your doshas. All right. So how could somebody, let's say someone knows their dosha, they went and saw a practitioner, they got the diagnostic measures of it. How would somebody tailor their practices, or maybe a practitioner, Ayurvedic practitioner, how would the Ayurvedic practitioner tailor recommendations based on somebody's specific dosha?
At the very foundational level, what will end up happening, and this is just the reality, unfortunately, well, we see practitioners when we need to see them. So something's going wrong in our life, in our body, in our mental health. So it's very likely that the doctor will say, this is who you are naturally, and this is how you help your body thrive, but this is what's gone wrong recently. So the first thing would be to get rid of the imbalances in your life. And this would be a combination of detoxes followed by rejuvenation practices. And the most profound detox is the panchakarma, but sometimes you can fix things with lighter detoxes, and then you'll start to add on things to bring the body into balance. And this would look like a 1 to 3 month type situation where you're tapering off medication. And by medication, I mostly mean herbs and some lifestyle practices that you might integrate, like self-abhyanga with a certain kind of medicated oil, which is abhyanga is just a word for self-massage or administered massage, shirodhra practices, where it's just very fun. They pour a lot of oil down on your proverbial third eye, if you will. She or he might taper your practices off as your body comes into balance. And once you've gotten rid of the imbalance and the toxins, which we think of ama in the Ayurvedic sense, then you will do things to keep your body in balance. So it'll be, don't eat foods that, let's say you are a natural vata, you'd be recommended not to eat too many foods that are drying. They'll probably take you off colas. They would probably take you off popcorn. They would say, hey, not a ton of cold salads. Try to cook your vegetables a little bit. Use warming spices. Whereas on the flip side, if I'm a pitta, I would be told to stay away from too many warming spices, everything in moderation, of course, and would be told to integrate some cooling practices in my life.
Mm-hmm. Got it. There's something so beautiful about just the imagery, the beautiful like plant medicine within Ayurveda that I think is lost within the sterilized, overly clinical aspect of Western medicine, right? The way you're talking about like oil being poured down and the beauty of these rich, colorful herbs that are being used and the sacred, I think, ritualistic, if you will, I guess, the ceremonial sacred aspect of some of this is, I mean, it's awe-inspiring for someone, for at least someone for me that loves health and nutrition, but also history and culture, don't you think?
You're absolutely right. And it bears repeating even to someone as myself who grew up around this. And in that, the science of medicine is that art of life a little bit, in that rituals stick when they are pleasurable. And sometimes rituals are beautiful because it's your body's intuition saying that it enjoys them and, you know, give me more of that or less of something just synthetic that involves, you know, clinically doing something to my body. And I do want to call out something that, you know, resonates with me a lot about your work, which is treating individuals as individuals. I think the rule of pharma is if a certain medicine works for 80% of the population, it must work for the other 20%. But we as individuals are so different, which is why people need to consult you to understand what shows up in their blood group, what's their DNA type, what you know might be missing in their life in terms of nutrition or what they might need more of. Similarly, Ayurveda's approach of individuality is something that encourages us to make this our own and respond to it. For some people, they might want to spend 3 hours in their morning yoga followed by oil pouring rituals with long baths. And for other people, that well-being ritual might be much more shortened, responding to the needs of their body. So indulgence to everyone's body is a different thing. And it is very important to understand what indulgence means to each one of us. While, of course, respecting that things that might feel good, if they truly feel good intuition-wise, not in terms of social pressure-wise, might be the body's natural response to wanting some wholesome things, whether it's food or massages and so on.
Yeah, for sure. And as we said, as you said earlier, that I want to maybe just highlight again, is that we're always in flux. And that's what Ayurveda really teaches. It's dynamic. We evolve. And maybe what serves us today isn't always going to be our thing. And I think that's really a deep wisdom on many levels, is not become so attached to identity on any level, right? It's okay to evolve and figure out and be curious, be intuitive on what your body needs. And that is true on so many levels, but specifically what we're talking about with health, we could have a dominant dosha and that can change as our life evolves. Is that correct to say?
And what's crazy to throw in there without, I hope it won't be too obfuscating the matters too much, but as we grow older, the vata inside our body increases. In fact, if you know, I used to volunteer at a retirement community a few years ago, and there are some similarities in the body types of older people. You know, they become a little bit smaller, their hair is a little bit more frayed, they sleep a little bit worse. All of them are vata qualities. So you're absolutely right. In the pursuit of sort of longevity, as we get older, we need to focus more on balancing vata than we probably did when we were 10 years old. And it's important to note that, respond to it, and adjust for it.
I never knew that. That's beautiful. And it makes complete sense. I didn't think about the, you know, universal shift of doses as we age. Maintaining muscle health is critically important to longevity and enduring good health in your body. Postbiotics, the active nutrients your body makes during digestion, are an emerging driver of optimal health. Urolithin A is one of the first postbiotics shown to have major health benefits and has become available to all of us. Urolithin A upgrades your body's cellular power grid, giving your body the energy it needs to optimize. Clinical studies have shown that 500 milligrams of Urolithin A alone, no other changes, significantly increases muscle strength, muscle endurance, energy with no other change in lifestyle. Again, my go-to for Urolithin A is MitoPure from Timeline Nutrition. I have used it personally for a long time. I had their chief medical officer on the podcast. I learned so much about the exciting science of mitophagy. Timeline Nutrition, which is a Swiss-based science company, is a global leader in Urolithin A research, and their products are NSF certified for sport. Timeline has MitoPure in 3 products. There's the berry powder. It's great to mix into your breakfast yogurt or your daily smoothie. There's the protein powder, which adds the muscle health benefits, of course, of whey protein to the bioenergetics of MitoPure. And the soft gels, which I typically take the soft gels for those days where you're on the run, I'll take it in between consulting patients online. Super convenient. Timeline is offering 10% off your first order of MitoPure. Go to timelinenutrition.com/WillCole. Use code WillCole to get 10% off your order. That's TimelineNutrition.com/WillCole. TimelineNutrition.com/WillCole. I recommend trying their starter pack, guys, with all 3 formats. You can see which one's your favorite. Let's call out the obvious. Everyone wants to head into the bedroom with confidence, feeling like the best version of themselves. But the problem is, sometimes our thoughts get in the way of our performance, and maybe we feel like we're just not reaching our full potential. What are our options? Pick up a sketchy gas station pill. We've all seen those, right? Or get prescribed a drug with a long list of potential side effects. That's where our friends over at Joy Mode come in. If you haven't heard about Joy Mode, listen up. Imagine a supplement. You can take like your favorite greens packet that gives you that extra dose of confidence and saves you the embarrassment and hassle of a traditional erection pill. Joy Mode's Sexual Performance Booster is an all-natural and science-backed solution to increase blood flow, firmness, stamina, and performance. It comes in a palm-sized packet like your favorite electrolyte powder. Stir it into 6 to 8 ounces of water 45 minutes before you're sexually active and watch the magic unfold, literally. Not only is this the only supplement you'll need in the bedroom, it also supports your blood vessels, your cardiovascular health, athletic performance, blood pressure, and so much more, people. Redefine your intimacy and go to usejoymode.com for 20% off with code WILLCOLE. That's 20% off and free shipping with code WILLCOLE at USEJOYMODE. Usejoymode.com. Great sex solved naturally. Something you touched on, I'd love to get more insight on, is when we were born, like the timing of it. I want to know about that. And somehow that, at least to some degree, determines an aspect of our dosha at some point in our life. And I think of, again, traditional Chinese medicine, or I think of astrology, the science of that. And, you know, we just don't understand the full breadth of it. Does it make it not true, or some aspects of it not true? Is that the where you were born, the time of conception? There is some science to it, or some understanding anecdotally to it. What's Ayurvedic's understanding of that aspect?
This is a great question. And, you know, I was smiling internally while you were going there, because just before you said the word astrology. So Ayurveda comes from the Vedas. There are four books, and astrology is Vedic astrology. So to answer precisely the two questions, one is, at the time you're born, the most predominant factor in influencing your dosha is actually your mother and father's dosha and their intention, their body type at that time. That's what's going to have the most profound impact on your dosha at conception. And many, many believe that as you are nurtured in your mother's womb, that will develop your dosha as well as the combination of the three doshas in your body more profoundly. So if your mother was happy, had great nutrition, good feelings at the time of conception and thereafter, you're likely to be born better balanced. Whereas if the opposite were true, it can have a profound negative impact on your doshic balance and how they interact throughout the course of your life. Now, Vedic astrology, which is a sister science to Ayurveda, takes the time of your birth, the precise place of your birth, and maps out where the planets are. And I just want to call out the difference between the Linda Goodman variety of astrology, where you're a Libra or a Virgo, et cetera, is very different from Vedic astrology, which basically goes very deeply into where the planets were at the time you were born and how they're going to influence your life at certain times based on their movement. So it's much more, I don't want to use the word precise in right or wrong, but precise mm-hmm. in terms of what it calls out to you. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about Vedic astrology, because I've been studying it a little bit more recently, is it gives you a pattern of things to do, if you will, to mitigate or better manage some of these forces of nature, for lack of a better word, you're presented with, as well as it can give you a little bit of a shining light on when you might choose to procrastinate certain decision-making. I'm not a huge fan of procrastinating decision-making as a rule, but in some cases, it indicates that phases of your life are better suited to take on certain adventures or certain businesses or not take them on. And basically, it serves to be a guidebook on how you should maybe consult the planetary positions when you're taking on some major things, or it can be answers to mm-hmm. difficult questions when you're stuck.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I love this. And it is like, you're right, this just the sun sign. And I'm by no means an expert in this at all. That's why I have you here. But the like sun sign is just one aspect of it. But yet I learn all of these other things that people that study astrology, whether it be Vedic astrology or other types, there's such a deep science, if you will, to this. It's not just flippant, the flippant sunshine, you know, and they have a little necklace for their sunshine. All right, so let's talk about Panchakarma. I have seen it done. Mm-hmm. I have had colleagues and friends done it. I have never done it. Walk me through this sort of legendary Ayurvedic therapy.
You know, and I appreciate your putting the emphasis on its legendary nature, because I like to call out that it is not for the faint-hearted, nor is it for the individual that is, you know, sort of just like checking into a light detox clinic type situation, because typically it will last 3 weeks. And there are phases to it. The phase basically is almost, I should not use this word, but basically you're initially just getting loosened up to get all the, excuse my word, crap out of your system. And I say this because you poop a lot during Panchakarma. So you're getting oiled, you're getting massaged about 2 hours a day, and you're taking internal ghee basically to loosen up wherever all the ama has gone and housed itself in your body. There's also sort of herbal smoke that you're subjected to, and, you know, sort of like that sweat lodge type sweating situation through heat. Okay. And basically, and all of these then get tailored, the choice of oil. So I just touched on the rituals, but the choice of oil, the choice of food, the choice of medicinal fumigation, all of that will be prescribed by your doctor based on what she or he sees as the core disturbance in your body. So you're sitting there, they're pouring oil into your belly button, pouring oil onto your forehead, but each one is different based on what is going wrong with you. In the past, you know, 1,000 years ago, this also involved a certain amount of bloodletting, but now it doesn't. I would say, especially because a little bit of the science and art has been lost, because for a few hundred years, the British essentially banned Ayurveda in India. So some of that was lost, and I wouldn't recommend, doctors don't do the bloodletting anyway anymore, but that was one part of old school Panchakarma. But you progress through these things, and basically once you're done with this program, you essentially eat one thing, one type of food all the time, and get all these massages. Some of it is pleasurable, some of it is painful, because a lot is coming out of your body from all your cavities. And then basically you've gotten rid of the imbalance. There's also an emotional component of the letting go of the imbalance. That's why you're quiet, you're by yourself, you're doing a light amount of yoga and meditation. You don't exert a lot during Panchakarma. And then basically following your Panchakarma is what the rejuvenation therapy starts. So then, you know, you bring in any your nootropics, your adaptogens, different food types. And then you basically get to go home. You're on a diet protocol for the first 3 days, 3 weeks, and slowly start to bring normal foods back in, keeping in mind moderation. Like many of the diets you recommend on your blog, sort of like elimination and then starting to bring things back. A few things I'd like to call out. This should only be done under the care of a practitioner to be successful. And it almost always is exclusively done at the center that the practitioner has, because it's a very hands-on, many, many people requiring situation.
Got it. Thank you for that. So it's tailored, it's bio-individual based on these diagnostic measures. And I'm assuming persons going to the clinic, they don't have to, this isn't a retreat center where you have to stay, even though I know they have those too. But is this something where I could go to an Ayurvedic practitioner locally and I could come home? I don't have to stay in the sweat lodge?
You are, great question. There are places that offer that. However, they do recommend, let's say you're going to a practitioner that is not in your city, that you find a hotel nearby so that they can give you the foods that are recommended during the, you know, 3 weeks is at the outer end. There are Panchakarma programs that last 7 to 10 days as well. And yes, if you had a great practitioner in your town, you absolutely could come back home and sleep in your own bed. they will say things like no TV, Will, no, you know, try to tuck away too much stimulation during this time. They will tell you not to work out too much. So, you know, don't hit your treadmill Stairmaster when you come home type of thing. But absolutely, you can return home and just manage their protocol.
Got it. So then it varies, right? You said anywhere between 7 days to maybe 3 weeks.
Yes.
Is this something that people typically take off from work to kind of dig into these deeper detoxes or panchakarma cleanses? What's the recommendation?
I hate to introduce the friction, but I think the answer is yes.
No work?
Well, you can work, and it certainly can be 2-3 hours of light work. But keep in mind, you're going through 2 or 3 treatments at the clinic on that day. You know, there are people massaging you, you're getting things poured on your forehead, you are talking to your doctor, she or he is measuring you daily. So it doesn't leave, to be perfectly honest, energy for a full day of work.
Right.
And again, you want to avoid things that are too stressful. And if work is stressful, then you probably want to take off. 2-3 hours can be managed if it's light work, but within reason. It is not something that you'll be able to do 8 hours a day off.
Yeah. So now you get like, I'm breaking out in a cold sweat. The idea of not working for 2 days, I can't do it. But I get it. This is serious. And this is a time to putting your self-care first. I want to try it sometime. It's on my list. I need to talk to you offline and see who you recommend. I want to do it just to experience it. And, you know, I'm fascinated by it.
I know you say that you're not working, but it would be profound work in a mental sense, in that, especially for someone like you, I could just see so many things going off that, and you have the discipline of just, you know, writing it down and coming back to them later, but the work will be happening. It will just not be maybe taping podcasts. So
amen to that.
Say,
amen. Yeah, I hear you.
Lots of work will happen for someone of your constitution.
I love it. And you're going to vibrate even higher. You'll take it to the next level afterwards. And no, I'm thinking of my patients. You know, but look, I'm the worst patient. And I tell my patients that all the time. I'm learning it as I age. The wisdom is finally coming up where I'm just like, no, the things I teach to patients, I need to put myself in it through the same, you know, the same process. And that is, you know, saying no sometimes. And for me to be the best clinician, it's sometimes taking care of my own health fully. So I do it day to day, but sometimes we need that longer sort of, I don't want to call it siesta, but this like break, this sort of Shabbat.
You are right. You know, in fact, Ayurveda back in the day recommended a panchakarma, not the 3 week one, every seasonal change.
Wow.
So like a real Ayurvedic practitioner will put themselves through this little panchakarma, because every season, this is life, you know. Just I wish I could practice everything I know. I can't. I wish food could be my medicine. It just can't. So we live in the real world of moderation, where I am on a variety of supplements that I've taken more and more of as I get older, because this is the stressful world that ages us faster than ever before, and we need coping mechanisms. So everything in moderation is what I think of. And when the time comes, you will go to your panchakarma.
I love it. I love it. So something you touched on that I want to go there. And like, again, knowing history, I didn't know this aspect of history, because I'm so glad you brought it up, is what the British Empire did at one point of outlawing this. And what they did, I'm wanting to know what they did in India, but they did the same thing around the world, kind of really made it illegal to practice these indigenous practices or languages. Even in Scotland, they did it. They outlawed a lot of the traditional things, but certainly around Africa and in India as well. So what did that look like? How long? And I guess some of that science and art was lost, is what you're saying, because people weren't practicing it. Is that what happened?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the genesis of it all was uniformity was necessary when you're trying to rule.
It.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So because Ayurvedic medicine that they didn't understand flew in the face of Western medicine. And I like to think we're at a confluence of everything existing side by side. You know, Ayurveda doesn't have tools for car accidents. Car accidents didn't exist at the time. So by no means is this a knock on a system or the other, but they did outlaw Ayurvedic medicine altogether because they were not being able to manage people's, their subjects' healthcare, if you will, in a way they understood best. And for a while, families, including my family, went a little bit underground, found other ways to do, because we would also grow the crops that would serve as the ashwagandha. Ayurvedic medicine is plant-based. So, you know, we grow gotu kola, we grow ashwagandha, things like that. And we changed some of our plants out to, now my family does more essential oil production rather than the Ayurvedic production that they did several hundred years ago. But a lot, it went underground in that it became family secrets and it got practiced within families, but parts of it are lost forever. Like Ayurvedic surgery, which Sushruta wrote a treatise on and, you know, may have performed the first plastic surgery thousands of years ago to treat someone's nasal cavity, is indeed lost because the practice is gone forever. Expertise in our part of the world went family to family through trainings, through gurukuls, where children would go when they were young and train under a practitioner for a couple of decades. All of that did get lost. So all of our systems were broken. And right now, Ayurveda serves as a system of life well-being that supports Western medicine, but I think a world where it could stand alone, unfortunately, without a full-on reinvestigation of everything that was lost, I don't think will happen. And it is sad, but it did happen. For 300 years, it was disintermediated by decree.
300 years. I mean, that's why history is so important. Beyond it being fascinating, we can learn what we've done. You know, today's generation doesn't even know that this happened. It's so important. And it wasn't even that long ago. And what can we learn today from it? I mean, authoritarianism, right? And censorship is like, you're afraid of something that's different than you. So you want to cancel it. We need to learn from that because it does not work.
I've 100 times over, take it from someone who's sort of lived in various parts of the world and seen the aspects of lost history, not being able to speak your mind or practice your beliefs can be very detrimental to the world at large.
Yeah. Diversity on every level, diversity of thought, diversity of practice, diversity of belief, so important. Otherwise, we become what we hate in others, right? It's like we judge it, but then we could become that either on a micro level or a macro level when you talk about governments and states. All right, so let's dive into skincare and beauty there, because we've talked a lot about this beauty, the sacred ancient art and science of it. You talk about oils and massaging. You have this beautiful ritual line that you put out in the world. I want for people to bring this Ayurvedic science and healing into their life for their skin. So how can we utilize some of this on a practical level from our skin, our largest organ?
I like to start with, you know, so the democratic answer. Ayurveda in terms of skincare is the kitchen pharmacy. A lot of things that Ayurveda recommends actually live in your kitchen a lot of the time. You know, you can whip up a honey lemon avocado fresh mask and, you know, put it on your skin, or there are various teas that will help you with detox. You certainly don't need to buy a product if you want to live the Ayurvedic life. Just eat fresh, eat local, eat seasonally are some of the things that Ayurveda recommends. But should you be someone that enjoys ritual, then you can dip into, you know, sort of fragrant oils like rose oil or jasmine oil or frankincense oil, sandalwood, things that we put together in our products that help make the process of oiling and anointing yourself more pleasurable. Or a hair oil that already has the Bring Raj, which might be difficult to secure. And one thing that I always talk about and think about natural ingredients is sourcing. You know, I know you've also touched on your podcasts about sometimes stuff taking on too much heavy metal or bioavailability and things like that. So it's important to see how a natural ingredient expresses itself in whether it's a skincare or, you know, an adaptogen that you take. So the second thing that I like to call out is we make everything organically, and we have farmed those lands for hundreds of years. So we know it's been organic for a long time. And I like to think Uma just helps create things that's efficacious for the skin, but also very pleasurable ritual. So, you know, we make things that are traditionally Indian, like the concept of a gommage, where instead exfoliation works by leaving something on your skin for about a minute and gently sloughing it off. And then sort of, so first you detox and then you oil yourself up. You've got things like Hansa wands, which are bronze wands, which help stimulate the marma points on your face. We recommend hair massages. Indian girls and boys are made to do a hair massage every time before they wash their hair. Body massages are recommended. Dry brushing is recommended. So these are sort of all Ayurvedic rituals that can also be moments of mindfulness, as I like to think about that. Take them back into your mind, your body, your being. See if something hurts inside emotionally or physically, mm-hmm. and check in with the body. So I think it's, you know, a 360 ritual, beauty, mind, as well as mindfulness.
Yeah, so you're bringing in these like micro self-care moments, if you will, these ritualistic Ayurvedic practices to the modern Western person using these high quality ingredients, these therapeutic medicinal plants, right, for our body. You mentioned the farming over like a few hundred years. Is this in your family? I mean, what's the backstory of this?
It is in my family.
Wow.
So we used to be the Ayurvedic family physicians for the Indian royal family before, you know, India kind of got taken over. And because we were treating the royals as well as the land, we got these parcels of land, you know, hundreds of acres to grow Ayurvedic herbs. And we still do that in parcels. However, some of it has moved over to crops of the essential oil nature. So in fact, we're one of the only families in India that can still do sandalwood oil because it comes back from the royal lineage. It is a very regulated oil in India. So all of this we've been farming, then we distill it down to essential oils, and that's what goes into the skincare and the wellness products we make. So it's Ayurveda from our farm and hundreds of years of doing it distilled down into a bottle.
Wow. I mean, this is blowing my mind. So this is your lineage. This is like these traditional Ayurvedic principles. Your family ancestors did this for the royal family of India.
Yes.
And now you're bringing this to the world today. I mean, you have to be in awe of the legacy that your ancestors, the fruition of what your ancestors started.
You know, it's hard to think about it like that just because it's such a tip of the iceberg situation in terms of Ayurveda being so vast. And, you know, I think all of us in this space of wellness want it to touch more lives more democratically. And I always, you know, sort of dwell on just like you know, you can't put work aside. It's hard to think about now Ayurveda is in more lives. And sometimes I wonder, why is it not in more lives? How do we get there? So I appreciate you calling it out. But I think in reality, the questions about how to make more people familiar with well-being principles keeps me up at night sometimes.
I love it. Well, you know, I just think there's a beautiful, you know, karmic, if you will, silver lining in all of this. Something that was subjugated and suppressed is now being reaching people around the world through your work and what you're doing today. So can you take people, because I did some research about this in between patients and my conversation for you, because I've loved your products for a long time. I did not know so much about the company, but now I do through today's conversation. But take me through a nighttime ritual. You mentioned that gommage, like what's someone do to bring this medicine for their skin and body into their life? What's the breakdown of the routine?
So I would say that in the situation that, you know, I hear Gwyneth Paltrow takes a bath every day. I know that may not be for everyone, but if you can start your unwinding ritual, whatever that might look like for you, if a bath is in your plans, please, by all means, take it with, you know, a ginger and a salt or our bath oil, which has a lot of chamomile and other essential oils that hydrate the skin, but also are an aromatherapeutic process. Now, whether you're showering or bathing, I recommend a first and a second cleanse because these are with very gentle products. We've got an oil-based cleanser that'll take your everything from the day off, makeup, sunscreen, and all the stuff that our skin picks up, whether we like it or not. And then I like following that up with the gommage at least 3 times a week. I leave it on and either I brush and floss around the time while it goes to dry. If you're a better person than I, oil pulling, I try to do it in the morning. But if you haven't gotten time in the morning, after I take the gommage off, I take a little bit of the oil pull and I step into the shower and I oil pull. And at the same time, you know, I think about the steam going to my face and further opening things up, clarifying all the dirt, spit out my oil pulling treatment. And then I basically start to apply the face oil. I do a face oil and I do a drop of the eye oil. And ideally use the Kansa wand to stimulate those marma points. It really helps with both detoxification and delivering a gentle massage to your face. If I am washing my hair the next morning, I'll do a little bit of hair oil. I always do a wellness oil on my feet and behind my ears. It's very fragrant aromatherapeutic oils. We make one for calm, one for rest, one for bliss. We also make one for energy, but I wouldn't do that at the nighttime. And this one's crazy, but I also put a drop of navel oil in my belly button every night before I go to sleep. I find it helps with detoxing, regularity, and also with hydration from within. One of the first things I notice in terms of sort of a beauty ritual, I don't need chapstick when I'm using the navel oil. So that's sort of like my night turn down ritual. It has a lot of oils, but it also has a lot of ritual, you know, sort of pleasure, thinking inward, so that I can, you know, sort of hit the hay in a mindful, happy way.
I love it. And you said the umbilicus, the belly button navel area is also one of the marma points,
an important
points, right?
Marma point, exactly. It is an important area. And if you go to a very trained healer therapist, and, you know, we can discuss that offline, they know exactly how to stimulate areas. But a light massage just around the folds and a little bit of oil application, you know, you can use an oil in your posit like coconut or olive if you don't have a navel oil, that will also help with overall body balance.
Got it. And I can confirm, I don't want to put Gwyneth on blast, but if you're over at dinner or at her house, she goes to bed early, which I do too. I'm like a grandfather at heart. She's drawing her bath by like 8:30 p.m. and it's a ritual for her. So I can confirm.
I've done a few events with her, but she is, yes, so I understand. And I do believe she does, you know, find a way to be that, you know, mindful about her bathing every day.
Yeah, right, for sure. And it's, I love a good bath too. I mean, it is, there's something sacred about it, right? All right, if you had to pick your favorite oil blend of what you make from this farm, from Uma, what would be your favorite oil?
You know, it changes because the body changes, the seasons change. I do find that I go back a lot to two products. I go back to a lot to our flawlessly firming neck oil. It was originally, I mean, it is formulated a little bit for the neck area, which tends to be delicate. But as I have gone older, you know, 6 years since I started the company, I use it a lot on my face. And anytime I'm traveling, it always hits the spot. So I love that one. And I love our absolute anti-aging body oil. It, you know, cheers me up every time. And it seems to have that effect on many people. So I'll throw one for the face / neck and one for the body out there.
I love it. As you know, the podcast is called The Art of Being Well. At the end of every episode, we do Your Art of Being Well. First question is, this is a good one. This is a good one. It doesn't have to be a traditional Indian food, but I would love if it is. What's the worst tasting healthy food that tastes disgusting, but you still have it because of its therapeutic benefits?
Oh gosh, I come from an Ayurvedic family. So there are
many bitter ones, pungent ones. Yeah.
So one that I'm eating regularly, and it's not that super pungent. And there is a capsule version of it, but in Ayurveda, the rasa is important. So sometimes when taking your supplement, the taste of it is important. Shatavari. It is white asparagus herb that helps with female hormonal balance. I take it mixed in my water. I don't love the taste. But because it's recommended in the water form, just because once your taste buds pick it up, then your body knows how to digest it better. In recent years, I take Shatavari, and that's one I always sort of squirm about doing, but I take it because it's so good for me.
Got it. And I think you highlight a big point here. From a digestive standpoint, these pungent, bitter, whatever tastes that we don't like in our Western like mind of, because everything's like one way, salty and sugary. But that's part of the therapeutic benefit is the taste and the signaling effects it has on the body, right?
Exactly. And, you know, you were scraping the surface, but tastes and rasa is a very important part of Ayurvedic therapy and how you balance your foods. Yes. And astringent is one we don't get enough, but we need in our mm-hmm. bodies. So, mm-hmm. you know, for me, it's two bitter pills at once, if you will, the Shatavari.
I love it. So this is a unique, I'm just like downloads, whatever comes to my mind. This is a very unique, Your Art of Being Well, because I have such a unique expert on the show today. Next question I have is, what is another Ayurvedic plant or herb oil that you use personally that you feel like more people should know about?
So it's called Drinkraj, and it's Eclipsa prostrata, and it is a little bit of an unheard gem outside India, but used a lot in India for the hair. And it's something that stimulates hair growth and is believed to delay premature graying, and almost has Rogaine-like properties. People believe in the scalp treatment ritual. So that's one that's very specific for hair. And I recommend that people sort of bring it in with, you know, throw it into your coconut oil or look for products with it, because as research evolves, you know, many of these unheard of. I don't know if 50 years ago people knew how beneficial turmeric was. And now we do. So this, I think some of these Ayurvedic gems will see their light of day in the scientific community. It's already starting to see. But that Drinkraj is a hair oil that really, really helps with hair fall and, you know, stress-related hair fall.
Got it. So this is something that's used topically, not orally?
People also take it orally, but it has both benefits. You'll find it in a lot of ingestibles inspired by Western medicine, including, you know, goop supplements and so on. So you'll find the product in there, but sometimes it's overlooked for its topical benefits. Drinkraj, it's what it's called. Eclipsa prostrata is the herb name.
Thank you for that. Next question, what's an Ayurvedic or ancient Indian practice that we talked about Panchakarma, but anything else, like something out of the box that you think is like not on the modern Western mind that you find to be really special?
Okay, so tongue scraping. I feel strongly about tongue scraping because at the surface level, it's already doing so much, such as giving you fresh breath. Tongue scraping with a tongue scraper, I should call that out. Some research seems to indicate if you do it with your brush, it can push toxins, because tongues are very porous, actually into your tongue. So using a tongue scraper, you know, you can get one for $3 or $5 or $10. We make one with pure copper for 10, but doing it morning and evening not only gets rid of all the ama that is on your tongue, but importantly, it enables you to taste your food better. And tasting food better is your, you know, gateway, not just to taste, but also telling your body when you're full, how much you've eaten. Things like we're not tasting our food, not taking enough delight in our food. So tongue scrapers are something I recommend in everyone's medicine cabinets. Very easy to do. Takes about 30 seconds. Very cheap to acquire. Start doing it. And, you know, at the very least, you have fresher breath.
Yeah, I love it. I used to do it and I quit doing it, but now this is my sign that I need to, you're calling me to something higher right now. I need to get a copper. I had one. I don't have it anymore. I don't know what happened to it, but a copper tongue scraper, that's what I'm going to get. I'm going to get yours. And how long are we doing it? We're just talking a few scrapes?
Yes, maybe three or four scrapes and you're done. You know, you see the difference. Your coated tongue just changes color. It looks like its normal pink self again.
Got it. Yeah. And when you say ama, is that toxins? Is that the kind of phrase for toxins?
How would exactly. You they deposit themselves inside our body. They're also created by unfavorable food combinations. as well as they deposit themselves on your tongue. They're a telltale sign. Ayurvedic practitioners first thing look at your tongue when they're examining you because okay. they can start to see what's inside.
Got it. I know, you know, this is your art of being well. Food combinations. I know this is such a central part of Ayurveda. So what is a food combination that works really well? And which one, what's a food combination that doesn't work really well?
I'll start with what doesn't work very well. I'm vegetarian. I have been all my life, but fish and milk don't work together. That's one of those things people tell you to avoid in the Ayurvedic practice. One of the things that they tell you to do together is when you're doing something that might not be good for your dosha, such as, oh my God, I should not be eating this, but I really want to, throwing in a spice that can help with the metabolism of it can really help. And it will really depend upon the kind of food. Like cumin can help make harder foods easier to digest in the body. And some types of teas can really defray the effect. And these get very specific, but I'm going to lead with that general direction of if you're doing things that you know you shouldn't be doing occasionally, please don't do them all the time. But if it's that occasional indulgence, Ayurveda will have two or three things to, you know, defray that one night of indulgence situation. And those are the combinations I'd recommend people look at.
I love it. What is your favorite tea?
Oh, great question. Right now, I am doing a lot of rose tea. And I think I'm just responding to finally, my pitta is out of control. I'm naturally pitta. And I do like my caffeine. So I'm trying to switch off it. And as instead of caffeine, I still do caffeine in the morning, but instead of a second cup, I'm switching a lot into rose tea, which tends to have a pacifying impact on my particular body. So it's recommended for my pitta type. And that's a tea I'm currently loving. And in as much as I can throw it in with an adaptogen so that I can get the adaptogen in, that's even better.
Love it. Where's your, do you, for the rose tea, is there a specific brand or are you getting this from a practitioner?
Yes, I love organic India. I pick it up typically from Whole Foods. It's easily available on an Amazon order. I always have it when I need it. So yes, that's the one I get.
I love it. All right. Last question. What's a book? It could be fiction or nonfiction that doesn't have to be about health, but could be about health that just really inspired you or like allowed you to see the world in a different way.
Oh, good gosh. This is a tough one. And, you know, I'm going to throw it out because I'm still working through it, to be perfectly honest. And it's not my favorite book, but it's one that has had a meaningful impact on my life for the last 18 months. It might be trite, but The Power of Now. I am still trying to figure out how to practice it. And maybe it's made 10% more of a difference, but I go back to it, you know, during my journaling, through my practices of becoming more present, because I think health, wellness, and just living life fully is done in the present. It's very difficult for me. So even though it's been a challenging book for me, I'll throw it out there as one that's definitely had a meaningful impact in my life.
It's one of the only books, his Eckhart Tolle, either The Power of Now or A New Earth, both of those, I go back to, because they're books, yes, but they're like these concepts that I think can be embedded within your psyche that you'll go back to. And there are certain things that he says that I've said to my kids who are now teenagers. I've said this since they were little. And they will recite them verbatim. And they're like these life principles of just sane living. I don't know how to describe it. I love that you said that. But I'll give you a little pro tip. Listen to the Audible, because his voice is a meditation in and of itself. And you don't have to intellectually always remember it, but it's these concepts that are like subconscious that I think is very, very calming.
That is super helpful, because I do love Audible. And it is the kind of book that I think you have to keep going back to, because it is layered and it packs in such a punch that I think it warrants going back to.
Yeah, I love it. My friend, where can people go to learn about your work, these products we talked about? Where do they go?
So umaoils.com is our website. M as in Mary, A as in Adam, oils, like the oils we talked about, .com. We do a lot of work on Ayurveda on the website. We're also launching a very deep repository featuring Ayurveda experts. You know, it'll have your astrologer on call. It'll have your Vastu expert, you know, the sister sciences of Ayurveda, like yoga and Vedic meditation and things like that. That's launching in 2 weeks' time. There'll be an encyclopedic edition about Ayurveda to Uma's, you know, existing commercial site, umaoils.com. And then I'll also say, you know, there are great other Ayurveda authors out there that you should get started on. Dr. Vasant Lad has some good books on Ayurveda in general that you can start, you know, your practice with.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's been such a pleasure.
Thanks again for listening to The Art of Being Well. If you have a chance, please rate and review the podcast here. And if you like what you're hearing, hit follow and pass it along to a friend. To see more, head to drwillcole.com/podcast. I'll be back again next Thursday, and I hope you will too. Talk soon.
Note that this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services. Individuals on the show may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to in this episode.